From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for the week ending January 29th.
And not soon enough.
It's been a long week then, apparently, for you. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio. The tired guy is Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly and big blogger for the Los Angeles Times. How do we identify you now? Is that your, like, joint title?
I've got one of those, you know.
Editor of Capital Weekly and blogger extraordinaire for the Los Angeles Times.
Did you get that? Editor slash blogger. That's, you know, it's quite a business card.
You should have gotten extraordinaire in the title when you took on that new duty. Anyway.
I'll renegotiate. I'll bring you in. You can be my agent.
Sweet. I get a cut. At least finally then I'll get paid. So here we are at the end of the month talking about, the same old stuff we always talk about.
But we're not starting with the budget.
No, not for 2 weeks in a row, we're not starting with the budget.
No. I have a feeling, actually, that 2010 we'll be talking about the other big issue, which we are starting with, and that's
politics.
Elections.
Yeah, elections and politics, which will be, you know, for people like you and me, this is fun.
Yes.
For other people, it's not so much fun, but that's why we do this. So, new poll at the end of the week from the Public Policy Institute of California. The other big statewide nonpartisan polling operation outside of the field poll. Field poll, we got last week some numbers, and PPIC, as we call them, got numbers this week. All right, so let's take a look at the races we've talked about. U.S. Senate, we have Tom Campbell, who just entered that race at 27%. This is the Republican primary. 27% for Campbell. Carly Fiorina, 16%. Chuck DeVore, 8%. And then in the governor's race, Republican primary, Meg Whitman, 41%. Steve Poizner, 11%. 30-point gap there. So before we talk about the theoretical matchups with the two Democratic incumbents, these mirror the field numbers in that Campbell and Whitman at big leads respectively in those races and, again, shows that why Campbell may have jumped out of the gubernatorial race. The numbers are somewhat different, but, I mean, they still keep this narrative somewhere in the same place, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But I think, you know, it's important at this point in the narrative to note that opinion polls at this juncture really are a reflection of name ID in races like those. Right. And that Tom Campbell was in the news a lot more than Carly Fiorina or Chuck DeVore in recent weeks. He's been in public office longer than any of them and in and out of public office and public service. And so, you know, people know him. A little bit more than they know Carly Fiorina or Chuck DeVore. I mean, you know, unspoken in that was at 27 plus 16 plus 8 is 24.
51.
48, 51. So you've still got half of the voters who have not decided, right? So still up for grabs, but it does show, it certainly does sort of seem to justify Campbell's decision to switch races. If nothing else, he's got a better chance in this race than he did in the race for governor.
Yeah, he's in a position where he can build on a lead rather than trying to claw his way up between, as we said last week, these people who have a lot of money.
Or it could go down.
Fair enough. No, right. I'm not rah-rahing for him, but I mean, he starts off in a better
Campbell
position.
Campbell lover.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what everybody seems to think, is that he's a media darling. But and then let's go to the gubernatorial race. I mean, again, a lot of people undecided, but this is a larger gap than Field even found. This is a 30-point gap between Poizner and Whitman. Even if the Poizner people think that the Whitman lead is not strong or not solid or it's still early in the game, it is early in the game, but 30 points still says something, I think, about what they have not done to date.
Yeah, this race has got to start sometime. I mean, we're talking about 5 months till the June primaries, and it's, you know, there's still some time, but as that gap gets bigger and bigger, Poizner's going to have to work harder and harder to close it. And, you know, it's I think we made the analogy to sort of the Jerry Brown campaign not ramping up. Well, Jerry Brown theoretically has until November, right, until voters really decide on his political future. Poizner is up in the Republican primary in June, and if he doesn't get started soon, he's never going to close that gap.
Yeah, and Whitman, and then Whitman gets another week of publicity this week, of national media publicity, where her book tour comes out, and she's doing the book tour, and she's doing the Today Show, and she's doing Fox News Channel, and I don't know what else
she's survived.
Done.
She overcame adversity and survived a 3-month camping trip with her parents.
Was
with
that
her mother.
In the book?
No, it was on the Today Show.
Oh, sorry.
Without GPS, she noted.
Ah.
Yes. She the can, things we overcome.
So she can find her way. Maybe that's the campaign slogan. But so she gets a lot of free publicity out of that. And again, national press. I mean, there was some discussion that, you know, we hadn't really seen Whitman in the media for a while, and now she's back out there, but she's national press. This isn't California press. And this
right.
is this again is another one of those pages from the Schwarzenegger playbook, I
Absolutely.
Would argue, which is
Absolutely.
Where you play at 30,000 feet, you play nationally, you play big. Only later when you have to will you come back and have to do what I would argue to be the nitty-gritty of dealing with people like you and me and
yeah.
other political reporters
God
who
forbid.
Cover the state.
Yeah, it's true, and it's been a criticism of Whitman, and frankly, I don't think anybody outside of the 20 reporters who cover the state.
Are there 20 still?
I don't think anybody cares. I mean, I think that it works as, you know, if they feel that she's engaged enough on issues, you know, I mean, whatever that means, if voters find their comfort zone with Whitman, whether they look, as much as I love Capital Weekly, even online at www.capitalweekly.net, I will concede begrudgingly that more people watch the Today Show, and perhaps even more Californians watch the Today Show than read the Capital Weekly. So
nice plug.
Yeah.
Nice plug while admitting your inferiority.
Self-deprecating
yes.
plug. Yes.
Well, let's go to the potential November matchups. And again, due respect to the other candidates, but just mentioning the candidates who are ahead at this point, just to try to see what a fall matchup would look like if the numbers stayed somewhere the same. Mm-hmm. In the Senate race, and I think we should talk about that one first because it also talks a little bit about the incumbent, Barbara Boxer, senator from Marin County. In the theoretical November matchup between Boxer and Campbell would be Boxer 45, Campbell 41. Boxer would lead Fiorina and DeVore as well if the election were held today, but by a little larger margin.
About
Campbell, 8 points. Campbell is the closest one there, 45-41,
right.
Which, again, plays into this narrative of Campbell's potential strength against Boxer. But also when PPIC asked about favorability and approval ratings, I think I should say, Boxer's job approval rating stands at 49% in this poll, with 44% having a negative view of her job. Compared, and the PPIC folks say when they looked at her job approval rating the last time she was up for election in February 2004, at about the same juncture before the general election, she was at 52%. Now, those are similar. But as you alluded to before we hit the record button for the podcast, as we all talk about, 50% is this number we all talk about.
It's magic,
a lot.
Right?
Yeah,
right. And whether it has lasting consequences, I think will depend on a lot of things about how the campaign develops, who her opponent is. But look, Barbara Boxer is a divisive politician. I mean, people have pretty strong opinions about her. She's more liberal than her counterpart, Dianne Feinstein, the other California U.S. senator. And I think there's a sense in California that, you know, she's often called the luckiest politician in California because she, in 1992, when she ran against Bruce Hershenson, she drew a conservative opponent. In 98, she ran against Matt Fong in a very strong Democratic year. And when Gray Davis was, you know, winning in a landslide against Dan Lundgren, and then ran against Bill Jones in 2004 in what was really a half-hearted, underfunded campaign. And so, you know, there's thought now, given what's going on nationally, this might be the year, finally, that her luck runs out. I mean, whether that happens, we'll see. But I think this poll, again, sort of using it as a continuation of the narrative, continues the narrative that she is potentially vulnerable.
And
is that qualified enough?
Qualified enough, but also, you know, as we said last week too, I mean, and we're somewhat, maybe this is the repetitive podcast, but
you can say that again.
Maybe this is the repetitive podcast. But national politics are going to be, I mean, this is the race where national politics will matter, rightly so, since you're talking about a seat in the Senate.
Right.
And, you know, since we watched a State of the Union speech this week that was kind of referred to in the national press as a reboot or a recasting of the narrative by the president, I mean, you know, I think, you know, Senator Boxer's fortunes are going to be tacked right along
they
in some
tied.
Ways there.
And she's benefited from, you know, from elections in the past where in California, at least, where 92, Bill Clinton was very strong in California. 98, Dan Lundgren was. 2004, John Kerry was very strong in California. So she's benefited from other politicians in the past. And we'll see if indeed there still is sort of an anti-democratic party sentiment come November, whether whether she's a victim of some of that.
And it's worth mentioning, too, in this PPIC poll, 61% job approval for the president. That's a 9-point drop since last February. Congress with a 36% job approval rating. And, you know, and I think this plays into the narrative, too, about, you know, can the president bring along people like Boxer if, in fact, it becomes a really difficult contest for her later on? Does his job approval bleed over or not bleed over, yada, right. yada, yada.
Well, and it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how, if at all, Boxer tries to differentiate herself from Obama or separate herself in order to win re-election. I mean, we saw it was a little thing, but the reappointment of Ben Bernanke. Well, that's a tough one for me to say this hour of the morning. It's the extra N, Bernanke. Anyway, Boxer came out against the Bernanke reappointment to the Federal Reserve. So, I mean, you know, little things, but it got my attention at least to sort of flag it and note it for as a politician running for reelection and sort of taking a stand different than that of the president.
Moving quickly to the gubernatorial possible matchup again. Due respect to Insurance Commissioner Poizner, Jerry Brown, Meg Whitman. Theoretical matchup at this point. The poll found Brown 41, Whitman 36, a 5-point gap. Again, right. A lot of undecideds, but continues the narrative we talked about last week, repetitive podcast of people are wondering,
getting closer. Right.
Yeah, how what kind of race would this be? Is Jerry Brown the absolute, you know, front runner that he is thought out to be, et cetera, et cetera? And, you know, we're starting to hear rumblings that we may finally get an announcement from Jerry Brown soon.
Right.
That he's going to step into the race, the official stepping into
the
race.
He did hire a campaign manager this week.
Right, exactly. Right. An old hand that he's had around before, his communications guy over the last time. And we're still hearing, you know, there's still a discussion that, you know, I read it online. I believe it's the guys who do the CalBuzz site. Give them a hat tip, a prop to them. It's their writing that the Brown campaign looks to be a lean and mean campaign. There's not going to be a lot of campaign consultants. I mean, this is one that, and maybe after 4 decades in public life in California, Jerry Brown thinks he knows how he can run most of this.
And what a contrast to the Whitman campaign, who was
hired. There are layers.
Whoever didn't get hired by Brown apparently got hired by Whitman, even though, no, different parties. But I do think that in a weird way, that may become an issue or a meta issue in this campaign, that Brown is going to position himself as, you know, the experienced hand who doesn't need to be handled by consultants, isn't packaged, isn't, you know, auctionable, if you want to use an eBay metaphor. Whereas Whitman is a product of political consultants. I think that for Brown, whether that's true or not, I think Brown will end up using her campaign spending against her somehow.
Well, right? and already has. I mean, in the one conversation he had recently with KGO Radio, where they kind of got him to talk about the campaign, which, you know, hasn't happened a lot, I think he said something to the effect of she's trying to buy the state or something.
Right.
And again, you hear that streak of money, no money, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, right. I mean, I think that's a reasonable narrative to look for. This poll, and this gets us the transition back to the painful budget process. This poll does ask a lot about budget questions and how voters feel about budget questions. I would argue there are not a lot of surprises here. People are leery of having their taxes raised. They want to protect K-12 education funding, which, you know, that word protect, we had a fight over already with the governor talking about he's protecting it, although the projected funding would go down by $2 billion under his budget because of the things that we'll talk about in a moment. They want that. You know, they would love to cut prison funding. They'd be willing to pay higher taxes for K-12. A slight majority would be willing to change the 2/3 budget requirement. That's going to get chewed over by a lot of people out there. So I don't find any of that surprising. I do want to just make quick mention and then flip into the budget world that Anthony's been covering this week. I want to make quick mention of something I wrote about online on Thursday. The fact that
KQED.org/capital notes, with an A.
Thank you. KQED.org/capital or capital notes.
Okay.
Either one will get you there.
But capital with an A. Unlike CapitalWeekly.net, capital with an O.
Promo time. It's like in the middle of the podcast, the promo time.
That's right.
Anyway, the thing that just stands out to me is that 49% of the people in this poll believe that the largest part of the budget of the general fund is spent on prisons. 49% think it's prisons.
I mean, that's not right.
That's not right. Only 16% got it right. K through 12 education.
So it's about,
and
yeah.
And so then you compare that to the fact that a reasonable number of people think you can solve this budget problem without taxes, and a large number of people want to protect K through 12 funding. There's a complete disconnect
right.
here. I mean, the voters don't know what they're doing.
Well, and the voters
and the last one, and I want to be careful. Sorry to all you voters, but it doesn't seem that they know how the budget runs. Here's why I say they don't know what they're doing sometimes, because 70 plus percent, I don't have the number in front of me, unfortunately, think that budget reform and big things about spending and taxes should be done at the ballot, not by the legislature and the governor. And yet they don't really know how the budget operates.
Well, in their defense,
defend the voter.
You know, prisons are, on a percentage basis, as a portion of the budget, correction spending is among the fastest growing portions of the budget. So even though we only spend about roughly 9% of the state budget on corrections, it is growing faster than almost every other segment of the budget. So that's probably what they meant.
Maybe, right? Maybe. But again, sticking with that, I mean, less than 10 cents. So let's keep on where you're going. Less
right.
than 10 cents of every dollar in the general fund in the budget as written for the current year.
Right.
Asterisks there, because we've got to fix it because of a deficit. But less than 10 cents of every dollar is going to be spent on corrections. 41 cents is going to be spent on K through 12 education,
right.
followed by about 24 cents on health and human services and about 15 cents or something like that, or maybe a little less than that, on higher education. But prisons is fourth out of that number.
Right.
And it's just such a glaring inability of the voters to know where the budget pie goes. And I don't know who, you know, and I asked the question open-endedly when I was writing. I don't know who's to blame for that. Elected officials, those of us in the press,
right.
The voters themselves, but they don't know how their tax dollars are being spent, and yet they're the ones in California driving the train with the ballot decisions.
To a large degree, that's true. But corrections is also one of the most contentious. I mean, you don't hear a lot of Republicans or Democrats saying, "Oh, we're spending too much on K through 12 education." I mean, that's bad politics, right? So where you
but
see,
you also
you
don't
squabbling.
Have a lot of people wanting to cut prisons in the Capitol. You
well,
can't.
Right. Well, we saw that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw this week on Monday, the state began implementing the scaled down corrections plan that was adopted 90 days ago, or 95 days ago now. That led to the reevaluation of some sentence. I have to be careful how I word this. It was not early release, right?
But
it began a process that will get some nonviolent offenders out of jail earlier than they would have been, out of prison earlier than they would have been. It's not early release.
It
right?
rejiggers how they serve the rest of their sentence,
their time, and it
modifies the parole system, which
right.
will result in a lower inmate population over time.
And so
we're hedging our words here because it's complicated.
And it's volatile.
And
language.
It's become politically charged
right.
about whether it's early release or something less than that. But go ahead.
But
sorry.
Point being that just setting this process in motion that would presumably let some people out of prison who are in prison now touched off a firestorm from victims' rights groups. You saw Democrats who are running for office, you know, get out there
and
criticize
the
governors. Right. And so to say in the abstract, I mean, this is sort of the larger point, to say in the abstract that you want to cut correction spending is one thing. But what do you want to cut? I mean, are you talking about letting prisoners out? Are you talking about, you know, what are voters talking about when they're talking about the desire to cut corrections spending?
Yeah, when 70% of them say cut correction spending, what do they mean?
Right.
What are they willing to live with?
And I think that it's like everything else with the budget. On the top line, you might say, okay, I don't want to pay more taxes, or I don't want to cut services, you know, but you know, at some point, voters have to have a realistic expectation of what it means to make cuts. I mean, saying that you want to cut health and human services even is one thing. But again, once you start getting into the details of, you know, closing health clinics or eliminating health coverage for poor kids, I mean, people don't want to do that. I mean, nobody wants to do that.
Right.
And so, we need to have an honest discussion about what we want our government to do and what we're willing to pay for. And that still hasn't happened.
And the other thing, too, is I've said this before, and I mean, it really does. You know, there's so many times where people talk about the legislature as dysfunctional and it doesn't represent Californians. And I think, unfortunately, it represents Californians way too well. I mean, you know, when Californians don't know what they want, the legislature doesn't know what it wants.
Right. Well, because they're trying to serve the voters so they can get reelected.
But I mean,
right?
there is some reflection of that strange disconnect in California.
Right.
Well, the budget politics got heated, became more heated this week, newly heated or reheated.
The rhetorical
it's reheated.
Temperature.
That's
reheated.
It. It's like we put it back in the microwave.
It was microwaved.
Yeah, we reheated this meal.
Right.
Yeah, the rhetoric went up. Talk about that. There was the flurry between the governor and the Dems.
Yeah. There's been so much.
Where do I begin?
There's been so much back and forth between the governor and the speaker over Speaker Karen Bass over the governor's tone towards Washington. This week we saw the governor get into it a little bit with the Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg. The governor sent out a release saying, you know, Democrats in the legislature disagree with President Obama's call not to raise taxes. And the governor's office listed a bunch of things that they identified as quote-unquote tax increases.
And not only just said that they disagreed with the president, but put up in the Capitol hallway, a looped video of the president on ABC saying, this is the worst time to raise taxes in the middle of a recession.
They took the Maria loop down for that, so you know it was pretty serious, right? They took Maria...
Oh, yes,
Maria
right.
Shriver
it was the display for her, right.
Yes,
so they took that out. And so making this great big point, you know, and again, grand flourish that the governor likes to do of making these points and the governor and his staff. And then now we got into this back and forth where Steinberg's staff, Pro Tem Steinberg's staff said our proposal for withholding taxes from independent contractors is not a tax increase. That's money they actually owe.
It's a revenue accelerator.
Well, no. But they're saying, why should people who pay their taxes have to foot the bill for people who are not paying their taxes?
Right.
And back and forth. And we're not here. Yeah, we're not here to figure out a winner or a loser or who's right or who's wrong. But that's not a great sign for harmony of solving the budget problem when right out of the gate we're having a tit for tat contest.
And yet, privately, behind closed doors, well, at least there seems to be some movement on the Democratic side in the legislature to begin to formulate counter proposals to what the governor put forth in January.
Something you wrote about Capital Weekly.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
That's strange. Funny you should ask. Well, I think we've talked here a little bit about this controversial proposal that the governor has to swap gasoline taxes, eliminating the sales tax on gasoline, replacing it with a flat excise tax.
And we referred to it a moment ago because that's the thing that impacts school funding because of the tax calculation. But yes.
Right. It also decimates transit, public transit funding, the way the governor put it together. And so the Democrats now are kicking around ideas that, you know, the version that we had heard, it's still in its infancy, I guess, or adolescence, but not quite cooked yet, to stick with the other metaphor. But
it's not warm enough yet. We're reheating, but you need to turn it on a few more seconds.
But the Democrats are talking about a tax swap of their own that would leave some transit funding in place and give locals more authority to raise. They would cut some gasoline taxes, but then give locals authority to raise them back up in order to pay for public transit. So is this a sign of progress? I don't know. It sort of felt like at least we're starting to see some specifics. And you know, if we're going to have a vote here in the next 2 weeks, right? I mean, mid-year budget correction, the clock is running on the Prop 58 special session fiscal emergency. If we're going to have a vote here in a couple of weeks, we need to start seeing some details. And, you know, I didn't get the sense before talking to staff that much was cooking. I mean, you look over in the assembly and I mean, all these caucuses are now in transition. We have a new assembly Republican leader coming into power next week.
Martin Garrick.
Right. We have a new speaker taking over March 1st.
And John Perez.
And even the Senate Republicans have elected their leader, although Dennis Hollingsworth will remain, presumably through the budget discussions, and then Bob Dutton will take over for him. So we've got, you know, leadership transitions. And I just didn't get the feeling, being in the Capitol this week, that there was a whole lot of progress going on. I mean, you ask, hey, is anything happening on the budget? And you just sort of get crickets, you know. Can you add the crickets sound effect?
Later. I'll get those in there.
Good, good.
You do get that feeling. And a couple of things, you know, in addition to all of, you know, to that or the lack of that, and that proposal, we'll see how it comes out once it's fully heated in the microwave.
Okay.
But a few other things that happened too. One, one that I think has to be mentioned really quickly. The Legislative Analyst Office has been putting out these overviews, analyses, you know, reviews of different parts of the governor's budget plans over the past week. We don't have to get into all of those. But, you know, for people who like...
Speeding cameras good and for budget, prison's bad.
Well, I was going to say, for budget geeks, they're kind of interesting, some of them. But the one I had to point out really quickly is the verbal smackdown of the governor's linking of higher ed funding for prisons.
Right.
This whole constitutional amendment idea that he put forward in the State of the State address that the legislative analyst says was ill-conceived. And then some. And there are a few things in that. I just want to point out something that I found really fascinating. Again, this is why I think the Ledge Analyst provides a valuable service. I don't want to be doing a commercial for the LAO's office, but I do.
We don't do commercials. But it's public radio.
But as a nonpartisan independent body that kind of is a watchdog, I think, to really look at what is in the, you know, in some of these policy things. The thing that I found most interesting out of that, just really quickly, is the fact that it would treat prison funding. It says it caps prison funding at 7% of the general fund, but it excludes all new prisons that might be built under the multi-billion-dollar plan that was put forward a couple of years ago.
So
you would have two tracks of prison funding. Older prisons would be under a cap. Newer prisons, all the spending on them, from guards to operations of everything, would not be under the cap. And, you know, it's these little details, you know, again, about putting things in the Constitution that should raise a red flag to people about, you know, layer on layer of the California Constitution having these things that the elected officials can't really touch.
Look, man, this ain't happening, all right?
Well, okay. No.
This prison's plan is not – it would have to be ratified by voters.
I think this was the final verdict on that it's not happening.
Yeah. This is another sort of, you know, half-baked – idea that we see. We've seen the governor throw a lot of these out. I don't think this one's going anywhere, frankly.
Well, but. So let's talk about what's on the horizon, which we did find out this week, which is that we're going to have finally the confirmation hearing, a confirmation hearing. Maybe it's the first one. I don't know where this will go. Abel Maldonado, Lieutenant Governor Designate.
Yes.
State Senator from the Central Coast will be on Wednesday afternoon before the Senate Rules Committee, State Senate
February
Rules
3rd.
Committee.
Yes.
And I think this is going to be interesting. I mean, we're hearing all these things that, you know, the Dems are still trying to figure out what they're going to do, all of the internal politics. The state Democratic Party is out there saying no to confirm Maldonado, but the reality of the budget and the process at the Capitol and all these other things may lead them somewhere else.
Well, and the interesting thing about the Rules Committee is that it's chaired by Daryl Steinberg, and so we will see on Wednesday. He'll presumably be putting up his own vote one way or the other on the Maldonado issue, and he'll sort of be tipping his hand as to where he is. Now, the interesting thing is if Steinberg wanted to confirm Maldonado, or if Steinberg and Bass together agreed that Maldonado should become lieutenant governor, the easiest thing for them to do politically would be to let the clock run February 22nd and allow him to become lieutenant governor automatically. The problem is that unless they approve him by February 13th to 16th, there's some debate. 16th, right. drop dead latest. It would force a separate election for the runoff.
Right.
So if they're going to be able to consolidate the runoff election in that Senate seat with the June primaries, they need to fast track and positively affirm his confirmation.
Well, we've got all these concurrent stopwatches running here, right? We've got the time frame on how the election process would have to work if there's a vacancy for his seat. We've got the time frame on his confirmation and how many days, and we've got the time frame on the governor's
budget.
Fiscal emergency and the special session and how long there is to operate on that before.
There's a couple of political stopwatches going too, though, because you know Steinberg wants Maldonado around for a budget vote. But if he's going to be confirmed by the 13th, that doesn't leave a lot of time for a budget vote. You're talking 2 weeks. Also, Democrats want to consolidate the election for a couple of reasons. Number one, they want to save the five counties money. I mean, that Senate district spans portions of five different counties. They would have to hold a separate election, millions of dollars. And number two, I think that Democrats feel if they have any chance at all of picking up that seat, knocking off Maldonado and what is sort of a moderate seat, that the only chance they would have, and it's still probably a long shot, would be to consolidate it with the June primary, because then you'd get at least more people voting in that primary, even though there's no contested Democratic races at the top of the ticket. More people voting then than would vote in a non-consolidated separate special election. Higher turnout presumably helps a Democrat, yada, yada, yada. These are the calculations that are going on. It's fascinating to watch these things running simultaneously.
Well, and let's just peel it back to raw politics just here at the very end. I mean, this is all about – at the end of the day, you get Democrats in a position of, do they want to give a Republican the lieutenant governor's position? Do they want to give it to him in an appointment, or do they want to leave this hanging until, the fall? And and what do you do to the Democrats who want the job outright and don't want an incumbent Republican sitting in there they have to contest with in November?
But there's a school of thought that says that if you defeat him on a purely partisan basis, right,
sure,
and don't, that you actually strengthen his hand for
because he's running for the job outright.
Right, right.
But this raw politics doesn't have any real easy path to understand. You've got a lot of the liberal grassroots out there online saying confirm Maldonado because we want the Senate seat. We want all these other things to happen. You've got the established party under the chairman, John Burton, making these public pronouncements through press releases and emails saying don't confirm Maldonado. I mean, so you've got these internal divisions within the Democratic Party.
And then,
you've got internal divisions, just really quickly, within the state Senate caucus because you've got, somebody who wants the job out of there.
Dean Flores.
Yeah. You've just got a lot.
And that's just the Democrats. Then you got the Republicans.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, right. We haven't even touched the Republicans.
Because Sam Onestad, another state senator, is running for the job. And then there are conservative Republicans who
don't like Maldonado
as a traitor.
For his votes to raise taxes and other things. Right.
So if he is confirmed, if he does get to 21 votes in the Senate and 41 votes in the Assembly, where are those votes going to come from? Are they going to come from Democrats? Are they going to come from Republicans? Some of both? It's an interesting calculation. I'm sure there are some Republicans who won't vote for his confirmation.
So just really quickly, for people who aren't at the Capitol all the time, the Senate Rules Committee would get this, and the Senate Rules Committee would have to send the nomination to the floor, right?
Well,
wouldn't they?
No, there's a process to withdraw the nomination out of committee, but it would take 21 votes.
But I guess what I was going to say is,
theoretically, the Rules Committee could vote
if the Rules Committee pushes it to the floor. You said we'll see what Senate Pro Tem Steinberg's feeling on this is by what happens in Rules Committee. But could he not just move it to the floor regardless of whether they're the votes to confirm or not? Because – and then he says, I did everything I could.
Yes. I believe –
And that's correct. Important for the governor and I think others if he says, look, I didn't stop it in committee.
Right. Well, I don't know if that would satisfy Abel Maldonado or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
We can all – draw our conclusions on that one, but or talk about it in 3 weeks.
Yes, or next
or
week.
Next week.
Next week after the hearing, we'll have a fine time to talk about all things lieutenant governor-esque.
And we could envision a scenario where they punt and say, hey, look, I've got problems with this nomination, but this is a matter for the full Senate. Let's move him out, and then we'll have a debate on the floor. So maybe that's what happens.
All right. Well, we'll see where it goes. So once that gets warmed up and everything else gets warmed up, we'll be back.
Then we can eat.
Then we can eat to completely take that analogy through, that metaphor through here. Anyway, for Anthony York from Capital Weekly and the LA Times blog, I'm John Myers.
I know that you are.
I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.